Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Lahava Harkov, diplomatic correspondent for the Jerusalem Post, and I'm here with editor-in-chief Yaakov Katz. And we're here as the borders are closing more and more because of the Omicron variant of COVID-19. Now people, Israelis cannot travel to the U.S., Canada, several other countries. What do you think of the latest developments?
Well, I can't say that I'm necessarily such a big fan of these closures. Here's my problem, Lahav. Bennett, about 3 weeks ago, the prime minister does this press conference on a Friday, right? Emergency press conference. I think it was 2:30 in the afternoon, that there's this new variant been discovered in South Africa. People need to be vigilant. They need to be careful. Saturday night comes along. And again, people need to be careful. It's a wave, it's coming, and people should not travel overseas. Now, what happens in the days after is that first, they try to restore the Shabak tracking system, right? That's the FBI equivalent in Israel. And then that falls to the side because they can't figure out what they want to do with that. Then we find out that his wife and kids are flying, I think, off to the Maldives or something like that for a Hanukkah vacation. So he had just told us not to fly, but his own family is flying. Then, you know, everyone's waiting to see, where is this Omicron thing? Where are the sick people? Where are the dead people? Where are the seriously ill people? And it's not coming. So I think what that then did was that people lost trust. They lost faith. The nation is not an accordion that you just open and close. You can't tighten the belt, loosen the belt without explaining to people what's really happening. And I think that that's why people are fed up with the situation. Right, they don't understand why we have these restrictions now, and that's a problem.
Well, and now we're on 1,000 people sick per day, and I think we've not had that situation since the summer. But on the other hand, we have, I think it's only about 10% of kids who can get vaccinated have been vaccinated. It's a very small number.
And I vaccinated both of my 5 to 11-year-olds are now double vaccinated.
Yeah, but so many people in the country have not done it, and the government's not been able to encourage people. And then there's about 1 million adults that are, I think, not vaccinated at all, and maybe even more who are not fully vaccinated. And, you know, hopefully the threat now of closures will get more people to be vaccinated so that we don't have to have those closures. But so far, it's not working.
Yeah, but you see, so this is the question that I wonder, right? Because no one can give me a straight answer. If you're triple vaccinated, right?
Yes.
I'm triple vaccinated. Okay, so if we're triple vaccinated, now we could still, there's breakthrough infections and we could still get the disease. But all data for now, at least, shows that people who are vaccinated, especially with the booster, are going to have a mild disease. Right. So the chance of something of a severe case, B, hospitalization, C, God forbid, death, is extremely, extremely, extremely unlikely. The likelihood of a rare disease happening to you, which could also happen. Right. So what is the purpose of all these restrictions? I guess, and this is kind of what I understood from Bennett when he spoke Sunday night to the nation, was to protect the unvaccinated. Right. Because there's still, like you said, there's about 6.5 million people have gotten 2 shots in the country, 4.5 million people have gotten 3 shots in the country. Take the fact that there's about 1 million kids who still haven't been vaccinated because only recently did we open up vaccinations to kids, and there's about 1 million people who had COVID in the country. So we're still missing about 1.5 to 2 million people who are just not vaccinated, right? And if that's the case, with all due respect to those people, they've had vaccines available for a year. Why are they not vaccinating? And I guess the reason is, and I've spoken to a few of them, right? I happen to know some people, they don't want to get vaccinated. So all these restrictions is actually, I think, going to have an adverse effect. It's not going to get people to vaccinate. The people who are not vaccinated are going to say, you see, even for vaccinated people, there are restrictions. What's the point in getting vaccinated? So I'm not sure this whole thing is actually going to work.
I mean, I know I think it was in Austria where they had a lockdown only for unvaccinated people. But then after a while, it didn't work. And then they went to a full lockdown. So I don't know. And I think that there's like legal issues that they can't.
I don't know that you need to do a lockdown for unvaccinated people, but I definitely don't think you need to do a lockdown for vaccinated people. 2 years into this thing with people completely vaccinated, I think you got to let people live their lives to an extent. Now, so far, we don't have a lockdown in Israel, just a closure of the skies, right? You can't fly now to the States, to Canada, to most of Europe, to definitely Africa. So Israelis are going to have to get used to staying put for a while.
Yeah. So I want to ask you, there, we had an interview this week with our longtime religious and diaspora affairs reporter, Jeremy Sharon, who's unfortunately leaving. But he interviewed the chief rabbi of South Africa.
Yes. Warren Goldstein.
Yes. Who said that it was a moral stain on Israel, that Israel's not letting people in. What do you think about that?
I respect Rabbi Goldstein, but I think he's taken it maybe a bit too far.
Yeah, I agree with you.
At the end of the day, Israel, I think it's complicated though. I don't agree with the people who make it black and white, right? Like Israel just has to care about itself. Doesn't have to care about anyone else. And the other people who say like what Rabbi Goldstein said is that it's a moral stain in Israel that we're blocking Jews from the diaspora from entering the country. There's a middle ground, right? On the one hand, yes, a country first and foremost has to protect its own people. That's our policies with Iran and the Palestinians and Hamas, etc. But at the same time, we can't ignore the fact that there are Jews around the world who have a deep connection to this country. And we have to find, I think, some way maybe to get them to come in. You mentioned Jeremy's interview with Warren Goldstein. I think he also interviewed Intelligence Minister Elazar Stern a week or two ago. And Minister Stern from the Yesh Atid party spoke about some sort of status for Jews, a way to help let Jews come into the country, even when we're not letting foreigners into the country.
It's possible. I think like also we are letting refugees come in. I mean, the whole status of the Ethiopians who are going to be making Aliyah now is complicated, but you know, they're in a situation where there's a civil war and we're letting them come, you know, and people who can make Aliyah not from war zones as well. You know, so I think that people sort of need to recognize that. And honestly, up until like 2 weeks ago, we were having birthright groups here.
Right.
So I do think that it's like a huge exaggeration to call this a moral stain. I know it's really difficult and really sad for people who are having family simchas here and they can't make it. But like, you know,
I got a phone call today from a friend, a coworker who is making a bar mitzvah for his son. And his parents, they're not going to be able to come from California. His sister won't be able to come.
Yeah, and I mean, sad. I get contacted all the time by people like, who do I need to talk to in the government to get my parents in for whatever? And I, you know, I wish them luck. I give them some phone numbers. But, you know, it's a difficult situation. But yeah, to call it a moral stain, I thought that that was really taking it very far. And I also think that
Lahav, the pain, I think, that and the frustration that Jews around the world feel. And if Israel is the Jewish state and does want to foster a connection with Jews of the world, then it does have to take that into consideration. I'm not saying that needs to impact policy all the way through, but it should be on your list of items that you and the government are considering. Okay, obviously, infection, spread, the R, right? The famous yeah. R, keeping people safe, et cetera. So maybe it's at the bottom of the list, but it should be there. And it should be an item that you say, okay, one second, how's this going to impact our relationship with the Jews of the world? For now, we don't care. We do care, but at least think about it for a second.
I do think, though, that there's a tendency sometimes for Jews in the world and sometimes leaders of Jewish groups in the world to like forget that Israel is a real country and real people live here and that it's not just...
Is that true?
Real people do live here? Like, it's not just this like Jewish tourist place Shtetl. That's waiting for them to come and visit and then like they're, you know... And so there needs to be a balance.
What that reminds me is that... So in the summer of 1993, my parents tell my older brother and I, we had two brothers who were 10 years younger. They were very young. Mm-hmm. I was then 14, that were moving to Israel for a year. 1 year turned into almost 30 years. But for us, my bar mitzvah had been in Israel. My brother's bar mitzvah had been in Israel. We'd been here for cousins' bar mitzvahs. We'd been to Israel maybe 5-6 times at that stage. To me, Israel was Ben Yehuda shopping, was the hikes in the Golan, was Masada, was the Dead Sea, was a lot. Like never in my mind did I believe that there is a high school in Israel I'd have to go to, right? That there's actual life and work and et cetera. So I do kind of relate to what you're saying, but, and that's wrong. I agree. But I'll just go back. I think there is a need to take this into consideration and just the impact it's having. People feel tied to this country. We want them to continue to feel tied to this country. We want Jews, even if they're not going to live here. And I think you understand like me that not all Jews are going to make Aliyah. Not all Jews are going to come here. And that's the reality, whether we like it or we don't, but that is the reality. And we should have an interest in wanting these Jews to feel connected to the state of Israel. There's enough already that's drawing us apart.
By the way, there's something particular with South African Jews that are especially angry about this. I'm not really sure what it is, but the angriest people I've seen have all been South Africans. I don't know if any of our listeners who are in South Africa have a theory. You can tweet it at me.
Well, I wonder if, because it also came after the whole LEK thing. you remember? So right. Ellie Kay was the South African Ole who had served in the army, was working as a security guard, I think, was working in the Western Wall.
Yeah, I think it was a tour guide.
A tour guide was walking through the Arab market, the Shuk, and was shot and killed by a terrorist just a few weeks ago. And then this whole thing came down with Omicron. Was discovered just a few days later, and it was like, and South Africa was immediately banned, and it made it look like here was a South African Ole who had paid with his life. He was good enough for that, but now we can't come to Israel.
And there was a case that there were people who flew in to make a Shiva call and then were turned away. It turned out that they had to were basically forced to fly on Shabbat. So that was a really big
Shabbat
mistake.
Observant people.
Yeah.
Right. Which again, be smart, right? Don't be bright. And I think that sometimes the government here misses. Yeah,
well, that brings us back to Jeremy again, who wrote this really great article about the population, immigration, and borders.
We should just dedicate this podcast to Jeremy today because to our listeners, Jeremy Sharon, who has been working for the Jerusalem Post for the last 10 years, is unfortunately leaving us. And I say that with great sadness.
Yeah.
I have great respect for Jeremy. I think he's been a real fantastic reporter and has really covered his beat in a huge, you know, he started actually in the copy desk. I was talking with him today. He started on the copy desk and then about 10 years ago was offered to move and become a reporter and took up the beat of religion and state pretty much. Then it was to cover the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox, which we're actually going to talk about at length with our guest this week. But he really got into it and I think he opened up a whole new world to Jerusalem Post readers of this dynamic of what's happening in this world of religion, of this relationship and the tension between religion and state in the state of Israel, which had been overlooked for a long time, I think, in our reporting and definitely in some of our in the other publications in this country, still don't report on it. I think it's one of the most important stories that we have in the country right now, and that's a lot thanks to Jeremy.
Yeah, completely agree. I think Jeremy's done a great job. You know, and he added the diaspora reporting a few years ago to his beat, and I think he's done a great job at that too. So, you know, we're going to miss you, Jeremy.
We'll wish you luck. But I have a question to you on following up with the, you know, diplomatic events that we've been talking a lot about on the podcast and obviously writing about Iran.
Yeah.
It seems to have fallen away, right? You know, now we're all, it's Omicron or whatever it's called. That's much more important. And no one's really focused on Vienna anymore and the Iranian pursuit of a nuclear weapon.
We don't celebrate Christmas. The Iranians don't celebrate Christmas, but the Europeans and the Americans do. Right. So they are taking a Christmas break and they're supposed to continue negotiating next week.
So the global battle to stop the proliferation of nuclear weapons stops for Christmas.
I know. It's really a little bit pathetic. But I mean, you know, you see people, the Europeans especially, constantly saying time is running out. But, you know, go tell a French person that they can't take their legally mandated vacation, right?
Which, by the way, will last at least till after the new year, I'm guessing, right?
Well, there's talk about them returning on the 27th. So the British still have Boxing Day, which is the day after Christmas.
Okay.
And then they're back. Mm-hmm. But
wait, is that, that's not boxing sport, that's boxing, putting things in boxes?
I don't know.
Okay, well, that's something for us to look up.
Yes. But they, so there's talk
about... Because that could go either way. It could be like families that didn't have a good family dinner, they start to box, or you've had all these gifts that you've opened.
Right, and unbox them.
And now you got to unbox them or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll look that up after this.
So they're supposed to be coming back after Christmas. In the meantime, you know, there's already today one of the I believe it was one of the negotiators threatened that, you know, if the talks don't go well, if sanctions aren't lifted, they're going to enrich to 90% enrichment, which is, you know, a nuclear bomb. That's how much enrichment you need for a bomb. So, you know, there really is no time to spare, despite the fact that they're taking Christmas break. And it just doesn't seem to be going anywhere.
Well, maybe the holiday will bring them some good luck in trying to find a new deal that would prevent the Iranians from getting a nuclear weapon, in Israel one day of having to take military action to stop Iran, right?
Right.
Which is still a possibility, I guess, one day in the future. Lahav, this week's our guest is Israel's communications minister, Yoaz Hendel. We sat with him for a bit of a lengthy interview, I think longer than usual, and you're actually writing the cover of this weekend's magazine in print about the interview with Yoaz Hendel and about the work that he's done. So just tell us, why is Yoaz at all interesting now? And why did we want to come meet him at his little tiny office in the Knesset?
Right. He has this tiny office because he's no longer a Knesset member. He's a Norwegian, as we call it. He's a minister who quit the Knesset. So he has this tiny little almost closet. But in any case, it makes for good sound.
Yes.
In any case, so Yoaz Hendel, he is planning this reform in the kosher phones. Kosher phones are these phones that a lot of Haredim use that don't have internet on them. And we go into it more in the interview. But the Haredim are very, very angry at him for wanting to regulate and reform this part of their lives. And he's sort of taken this opportunity to turn it into something that's more than just phones and to talk about the principle of the matter of rule of law in Israel and how there shouldn't be different laws or different application of the laws for different Haredi population
and a Haredi autonomy, as he describes it in the interview, right? Their ability to do whatever they want without.
Right, and he talks about Israeli Arabs as well. Although the reason he's become the face of this is because of Haredi.
Well, because also what happened was right, and we ask him about this, but I think it's important to underscore the significance. Right, the Vizhnitz Rebbe, who is this old Hasidic master, right?
I guess. And the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir, which
the head of the Mir Yeshiva, which is one of the flagship yeshivas in Jerusalem. And a long list of other very high-level rabbis came to his office to meet with him. Now, we've seen, as you mentioned, we've seen politicians, in the interview you say this, we've seen politicians go to these rabbis and to get blessings and, you know, and to get them to get their followers to vote a certain way or something like that. But I don't think, I mean, I've never seen these rabbis come to a minister's office, right? That was pretty significant.
It is significant, and he stood his ground. You know, usually people show a lot of deference to these rabbis. I mean, he sends, you know, Minister Hendel says that he was respectful to them. I'm not saying he wasn't, but the Haredim didn't feel that way, who saw videos of this. They didn't feel that he showed proper deference because he stood there and he said, you have your values and I have my values and my values are important too. And that's not something that you hear.
And also he didn't do something like, you know, I'm sure everyone has seen these pictures of, for example, former Prime Minister Netanyahu, who whenever he would go visit, whether it was Rabbi Avadi Yosef or some other rabbi, he would put on a kippah, right? So when these rabbis came to Yoaz Hendel's office, he did not don a yarmulke, and people got upset at him about that. But we ask him about that in the interview, and he gives, I think, a very interesting answer. So stay tuned. Really interesting interview with Israel's Minister of Communications, Yoaz Hendel. So we're here with Yoaz Hendel, the Israeli communication minister and member of the New Hope Party, and Dr. Yoaz Hendel, who previously served also for a period of time in the prime minister's office under Benjamin Netanyahu, was the head of the Zionist Strategies Institute, longtime commentator on military political affairs, I actually co-authored a book with him also, I have to say, I guess as a disclaimer, about 10 years ago. But we're talking with Yoaz because he's really standing at the forefront today of, I think we could describe it, Lahav, as something of like a clash between this coalition and the Haredi ultra-Orthodox parties. And for Minister Hendel, it's really focuses on this whole kosher phone business. So could you explain to us, what is the business with the kosher phones? Why are the ultra-Orthodox getting so bent out of shape? And what is it that you're trying to do? And why is it, in your eyes, a good thing while they're the ones who are saying this is terrible for the Jewish people?
Okay, so shalom Lav, shalom Yaakov. I'm very happy to be here in your podcast. I think that, first of all, it's not about kosher phones. It's about the character of Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. And one of the things that the majority of the Israelis will agree with me is that in the last, I would say, 2-3 decades, we lost our sovereignty on different parts of Israel. We actually, if we look on Ben-Gurion period, when he talked about how to unite the country and how to bring different tribes from different parts of the world, Tfutzot Israel, and to make Kur Hituch, how to translate Kur Hituch?
To make it a melting pot.
Yeah. Exactly. Today, or after Ben-Gurion period, we actually moved to the next episode, which you can find it in the very famous speech of ex-president Rivlin, the tribes speech, which means that you have here four tribes or five or six, you can pick whatever you like. and will live next to each other. And every tribe is equal to another. From my point of view, we need to change direction. We need to go back to Zionism, to the core of Zionism, and to agree on the character of Israel as a Jewish and democratic state, safe one and just one, to agree on the fact that you have here rights and duties, equal rights and duties, to agree that everyone is under the law, the Israeli law, and to agree that there are no autonomies in Israel. First of all, the most, I would say, important part or most challenging part is the Bedouins in the Negev or the Arabic population, the average of violence, the illegal weapons, the crimes, in one world chaos. Chaos in the Negev and in the Galilee, which created by autonomy, an Arabic autonomy, that for many years the prime minister, the former prime minister, the ministers, the decision makers choose not to choose and not to take any decision. And we found ourselves in the last military campaign with an Arabic population that raised again against the state of Israel, actually. The second part of this idea or this challenge, with all the differences, is what's happening in the ultra-Orthodox community. Then we saw a few problems in the corona, in the second round of the corona last year, and we see it today. And in my job as a Minister of Communications, I deal with regulation. And when you are a regulator, usually you have to make sure that the regulation is on everyone, in every place, on every company. What I found that there is a regulation on everyone except for the ultra-Orthodox. The kosher fonts, actually, it's a kind of a monopoly that out of order, law and order. It's a vacuum. You have over there a committee which no one knows what exactly they are doing. They block different calls for ultra-Orthodox that wants to call to emergency calls or to different business houses or whatever.
Well, maybe we could just pause here and I'll just explain for our listeners what kosher phones are, because they're so...
Right, you're right. So we need to explain it.
Yeah. They're not smartphones like what we all have.
Right, they're phones that some in the Haredi community use that only work as phones. So no cameras, no apps, no texting. Do they have texting? I think
they have text messages,
but not WhatsApp.
No WhatsApp.
Right. And the numbers are specific to kosher phones. So if they start with certain numbers, you know that they're kosher phones. And as you were saying, there's a committee of, I guess, rabbis who oversee the content that they're allowed to and which numbers are blocked or not.
Exactly. And the idea, if I can explain them approach, is to create or to keep or to maintain the ghetto. This is what they told me in this meeting.
They use the word ghetto?
They use the word ghetto.
Uh-huh.
To keep the ghetto. To keep Israel out of the ghetto, the state of Israel. Now, what I told them, you cannot hold the stick in both sides. In one side, to have the power to be part of the government for many years, to put ministers, ultra-Orthodox minister. In the other hand, to say, look, I don't want the state of Israel will interfere in my life. This is a kind of autonomy. This is my ghetto. I don't want that the state of Israel will be there. So if you are taking the kosher phones, they decide they want to block or to create a ghetto from the internet, which makes sense. I don't care if...
Because the internet to them is this external threat.
It's the devil, as they define it. And it's okay.
Because
it's okay.
Of the content that their children will be exposed to.
Right. And you know what? I agree. It's part of the claims that they have about the internet and about how we need to protect our kids from the internet and to make sure that... And to filter the content that they are getting from different sources. But at the same time, you cannot hold a 500,000 people and to tell them, look, you have only one program, which is the kosher program, and you cannot transfer to other programs while all Israelis can move From company to company, from program to program.
Because it, from provider to provider, because it kills competition, essentially.
It kills competition. Now, what the committee of rabbis are doing, which is not really rabbis, it's committee of people that actually...
Of machers.
Of machers, yes. This is the right word.
Jews know the word machers.
Yes, exactly. So what they are doing is, first of all, to decide what kind of numbers they block and what kind of numbers that they allow to the customers, mm-hmm. the subscribers, which... Sometimes you can find a pizza, a normal pizza that belonged to an ultra-Orthodox guy in Jerusalem or in Bnei Brak that blocked by the rabbi's committee. Why? No one has to give an explanation. No one has to answer the phone. No one actually deal with that. They just blocked it. No one knows the reason. The other side is, or the second problem is that they choose who can bring to Israel mobile phones, who can import, who can sell, and who not. And I'm talking about domestic issues. I'm talking about businessmen from the ultra-Orthodox communities. Maybe it's more precise. And the third problem is that the ability to a citizen, an ultra-Orthodox or a secular or a modern Orthodox, to move from a plan to plan, from a company to company, to choose his own kashrut, to decide if he want to block all internet, or if he want to block everything, or he just want to block the camera, or he just want to block SMSs or whatever, or maybe he's an apicurist suddenly, and he want to have a normal phone. I don't know. But
Minister Hendel, how many people, Haredim, have, because I've seen different reports, that they say that half of them actually have two phones, right? They carry one in their left pocket of their jacket, the kosher phone, and in the right pocket of their jacket, they carry a Galaxy or iPhone.
Actually, Lav can tell you exactly what is the number, because she knows the Knesset quite good, and she knows the ultra-Orthodox Knesset members, so it can tell you which kind of Knesset members send their WhatsApp and they know how to communicate
with
this miracle machine which called the smartphone. Uh-huh. When we had the meeting with the rabbis, with the admorim and the representatives of the rabbinic committee, part of the mishamshim came with smartphone and actually took pictures the whole meeting and record the meeting through these smartphones. But what I'm trying to say is that if you pick the numbers, or if you analyze the numbers, we're talking about minimum of 50% of the ultra-Orthodox mm-hmm. Populations that use internet. There are numbers that are different assumptions above 70%. A lot of ultra-Orthodox around those numbers are using two mobile phones. One is kosher and one of them is not kosher. And yes, they use the kosher number in order to have a kind of ID, mm-hmm. in order to put the kids in the schools, in elementary schools and in the yeshivot. And from my point of view as a regulator, it's not the role of a mobile phone. It's the role of, they can pick something else, but you have to let the ultra-Orthodox citizens in Israel to have competition. And they can pick whatever they want to, any program they want to, and no one can pick for them. No one can choose right. for them, for 500,000 people, what they can do and what they cannot do.
So you had this meeting several weeks ago with the Admor Mivizhnitz and the head of the Mir Yeshiva and huge major Haredi figures that... I don't think we've ever seen them come to a minister's office the way that they came to you. Usually it's the other way around. Politicians come and they sort of pay tribute to these big rabbis. And you made real sort of statements of principle. What you're saying now, that it's not even so much about the phones, it's a matter of principle that there should be one law for everyone. Could you tell us a little bit about how that meeting went? I think these are things that few people say to these rabbis' faces.
So first of all, I didn't plan, you know, meetings that will be such a sin at the media the day after. I thought that the committee of rabbis are bringing a few rabbis and I will meet with them. I agreed to meet. I thought that they want to talk with me about this issue of mobility of the mobile phones. And after that, they told me that a few, that the Admorim are going to come and the famous rabbis. And I, of course, I prepared myself and I came and I thought that I react in a very decent way. And
respectful.
Yeah. This is how I saw things.
Because they said later, like, you didn't put a kippah on, for example, for the meeting.
So I answered this criticism. First of all, I'm not wearing kippah when I'm not in Shabbat. In Shabbat, you know me, I'm using kippah when I'm going to synagogue, to shul, or when I'm having Shabbat dinner, or in general in Shabbat, when I'm sitting in my office. And I must remind our listeners that this is an official office. It's a ministry. When I'm sitting there and talking and dealing and discussing professional issues, I'm not wearing a kippah. This is not the place to wear a kippah for me. The other people that use kippah daily, I'm not. So I didn't think that this is a good show to put kippah when I'm meeting rabbanim that ask to meet with me in my office. First of all, and I don't think that this is a message. It's just me. This is how I'm reacting and acting day by day. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I sat there for 1 hour. I listened for many things for all the things that they said. It was not an easy hour. They talked about how they discern in their life, and they are not willing to compromise, which means that I'm willing to compromise on other things. They talked about the education of them kids and how it's important for them. For us, it's not that important, but for them, it's very important. And they talked about the ghetto, and they talked about the Holocaust, if I will take a decisions regarding the mobile phones, the kosher mobile phones. And I heard for 1 hour.
They compared that to the Holocaust.
Yeah, to take a decision like that, it's an Holocaust for them.
Wow.
And one of them said that, and they talked about Mityavnim and about Maccabim. It was in the middle of Hanukkah.
That you are like Antiochus, the story of...
They didn't call me Antiochus. they were also
but
very
like
respectful.
Like the Jews who assimilated with the Greeks and the Hanukkah story.
They used this as a Dvar Torah, a Dvot, to explain how important it is to keep this... It's niut of modesty of and how to run away from the internet. And all the whole discussion was very philosophical. It wasn't about the shimua, the hearings that I have regarding the mobile phones, the kosher mobile phones. It was about philosophical ideas and how to reject the internet. And I agree. I told you, I think that to have a kosher phone or to filter the content that our kids use, it's very important, and I'm dealing with that in other aspects of my work. And after that, for 5 minutes, I talked about my perspective, and I told them that I'm really respectful for what they did and for the fact that they came here, and they made the effort to come to my office, and I must tell them that I taking care of my kids as they take care of them kids, and we spoke about, I said that I'm also have concerns regarding the internet, but at the same time, I told them, I have to tell you the truth, that 50% of your population is connected to internet day by day. This is the numbers that we have. Now, you cannot ignore that. And I will hear you, I will listen to everything, and I'm willing to meet with you every whenever you want.
You also, though, brought up this whole thing, this idea of agala reka and agala melea, and I think the background to that Lahav was explaining to me before, right, is, Lahav, you want to tell our listeners?
The Chazon Ish, yeah.
Right, so Ben Gurion met with the Chazon Ish, who was like the major Haredi rabbi of the time in, you know, the late 1940s, early 1950s.
In 52, I think.
It was 52, okay. Yeah. And in the meeting, they were talking about military service, and there were several hundred yeshiva students who the Chazon Ish didn't want to have to serve in the IDF. And the Chazon Ish said this sort of parable where he actually said two camels, but it somehow in Israeli parlance it's turned into two wagons. But one is full with load, like has loads on its back, and the other is an empty camel that has nothing on its back. So the camel with nothing on his back has to make way for the full camel. And the camel with lots of loads on his back is supposed to be the Haredim, that they're full of this Jewish concept of the Jewish world.
And the secular have nothing.
And the secular world is empty. And this is a very famous parable. And Ben-Gurion, I'm sure, did not agree that the secular world is empty, but he said, okay, for your few hundred yeshiva students, we won't make you serve in the army. And we all know how that's turned out many decades later.
But your point, Yoaz, was that you have a full wagon, right? Well, what were you trying to say to them?
I have also a full wagon. I didn't say anything about them wagon, but I cannot accept the idea that I'm willing to compromise while they are determined about them ideological ideas. I have also a philosophical view. I have also ideas, and I see Israel, the state of Israel, as a place of all Jews from all over the world. All Jews, including different streams in Judaism. I see Israel as the place of Jews from all over the world. And not only, and I cannot accept the idea that there is a monopoly of Judaism only that belong to the ultra-Orthodox community. And when I talked about the full wagon, my full wagon, it's not about them, it's based on my perspective. And I have, I think, the whole reason to think like that my wagon is full of Gemara, Talmud, full of Jewish heritage, Jewish sources, and at the same wagon I have also Bialik and Rachel and Leonard Cohen and other Jewish creators.
You mentioned your IDF service, right?
Yeah, I talked about my IDF service when they talked about compromising. And I said, look, I understand that you are nechushim.
Determined.
Determined. And I understand that. But I'm also determined. When I served in the Shayetet Shlosa, in the Israeli Navy SEALs, a soldier in the Navy SEALs is no less determined than the yeshiva buchers that learned Torah from morning until night. And what I try to say in the subtext that you cannot think about yourself as the only determined people in Israel. And yes, there is a discussion, and I'm willing to have this discussion, but in equal way.
Yeah, but what's interesting is what's happened since then is, I mean, there's been videos, and I've watched some of these scenes play out here in the Knesset, right, of screaming matches between you and Moshe Gafni, of these Haredi Knesset members who really are coming after you in a way that I haven't really seen them go after other Knesset members. Maybe Bennett, who they're also very upset with, and they've told him to take off
and
his kippah. And Matan Kahana, right? Because like you said, you don't wear a kippah on a daily basis, they can't tell you to take it off, right? But everyone else...
instead of telling me to take it off, they're telling me, put a kippah when you want me.
So you should put a kippah.
They choose if they want us to put a kippah or
to take off the kippah. Yeah. But
we're waiting for the decision.
They're waiting from the rabbinic committee. But the point is that to an extent, it seems like this government, and together with Matan Kahana, who's the religious services minister, and he's pushed through this kashrut reform, which is breaking up the monopoly of the chief rabbinate and of the also some other Haredi groups. So they're getting hurt by that in their eyes. They're getting hurt by the kosher phone thing. This government is doing a lot to break up some of this hold that the Haredim have had on religion state issues in this country. And it's something they've never experienced before, I think.
Maybe, but this is, I think, an opportunity to take the hot potatoes for them, not for the seculars in Israel, for them, to make sure that they are getting a decent competition in the mobile phones market, and to make sure that we have different kashrut. For me, it's important for kashrut. Maybe seculars don't care. Maybe Netanyahu doesn't care about kashrut. He doesn't use kashrut. But I'm
based on some of the reports about the restaurants he's visited on his trips to New York
and some of the
food that apparently he's been spotted eating. I don't know if kashrut is at the top of his list of priorities.
But. Yeah, exactly. And I eat kasher. So when I'm looking for kashrut, I don't want that someone macher will earn money from my will to have a kasher meal. So I think that this is important for the Israelis, and when I'm taking care of the mobile phones, it's important for the Israeli ultra-Orthodox citizens, and on and on. And this is a really unique opportunity when the ultra-Orthodox are not part of the government to take care to the ultra-Orthodox communities. What I'm arguing with them is, first of all, that we are not in the Gola. When Gafni is telling me that I'm Paritz, I must remind him that we are in sovereign state of Israel. And unfortunately, what I felt that you can take Jews from the diaspora, but you cannot take the diaspora from the Jews. This is what I saw in Gafni character. When he shouting Paritz and we'll go to the Palestinian Authority to use them fonts and on and on. This is.
I mean, even the use of this term, the ghetto in the state of Israel, is also. The ghetto was established by non-Jews to keep Jewish populations in Europe in a single community, so they wouldn't be able to integrate and assimilate into the larger society.
Exactly. So, right. This is all about, I think, the gap between the state of Israel and the autonomies. And in this case, the ultra-Orthodox autonomy. Mm-hmm. My role as an Israeli minister, it's not about communications minister. As an Israeli minister, is to make sure that the future of Israel, the state of Israel, will be that we will be able to maintain this miracle. And we will not be able to maintain the state of Israel, this miracle, if we will allow ourselves to become tribes or to allow autonomies everywhere and to allow ourselves or to ignore the fact that there is one law to one person and another law to another, that in right. Tel Aviv you have law and order, and in the Negev, in the Bedouins community, you have nothing, or in the ultra-Orthodox. We have to change the direction, to change the direction of this train, and for many years, the government of Israel ignored it.
Well, let me challenge you a little bit on that. I think the most controversial, one of the most controversial laws that this government's working on right now is the electricity law, which is to allow Bedouins to be connected to the electric grid despite having completely illegal construction. And that seems to be, again, allowing an autonomous group of people, allowing them to bend the law and to still sort of get the benefits of people who keep the law. So how do you, you know, have those two things in one government?
First of all, it's not about the Bedouins. It's about illegal houses that exist for many years. And I must remind our listeners that in the last 10 decades, in 2014 and 2017, the government of Israel, which was ruled by Benjamin Netanyahu, actually signed this bill and gave this electricity to those people. Mm. Now, so it's about, how I see it, it's about actually organize the chaos. Try to organize the chaos. I have a similar problem in my field. We had a pirate companies that actually stole connections of Bezek and Hot and other companies and use it in the Arabic population. We saw it in electricity. We saw it in water. In actually, the chaos of the Arabic population spread everywhere. And what I chose to do is to tell to those pirates, you have two options. Or to go to the Ministry of Communications and to have license, to start the process and to have license, and we will supervise you. This is the one opportunity. Or we will use illegal tools and we will make sure that you will not walk anymore and we will use force and we will make sure that you will lose. Mm-hmm. After... And we gave them the 1st of November. From 30 companies, 29 companies choose to ask for permission, to ask for license, to pay the tax, and to have themselves under the supervision of the ministry. One company chose the other option, and we use our legal tools. But I think that this is the tools that we need to use, to have the stick, a strong stick, very strong stick, because this is what we need in the Negev and the Galilee, and in the other side, the carrot. Unfortunately, the state of Israel for at least 20 years, we choose not to pick not the stick and not the carrot.
And that's how all this lawlessness was created.
Exactly.
I want to switch topics for a moment. In the ministry, you don't just deal with Haredi issues, right? There's a lot
You're
else.
Right.
There's a lot of other things that happen in Israel.
Optic fibers.
Right.
And
there's
other,
yeah, and I see here on the shelf is a model of a satellite.
Right.
So the Ministry of Communications, one of the things, your flagship project, and you've been in this ministry now for almost about 2 years, I think. Right.
Right.
Is to basically deploy or to install fiber optic cables throughout the country to bring high-speed internet to every corner of the state of Israel, from the Negev and from the border with Egypt, where you kind of like the famous Hebrew saying of Sofa Olam Smola, you go to the end of the world and you take a left, and that's where the border with Egypt is, all the way to the north into the Judean Samaria, into the West Bank. I'm hoping one day also in Jerusalem, where I live, but you know, maybe
there is in Jerusalem. There is in Jerusalem. You live, I hope that very soon you will right. see competition of it.
Okay, so first of all, where's that fiber optic cable situation? Where is the 5G situation stand? And also, maybe this is a lot to unpack, but you recently signed a big deal with Google, I think it was, right, for an underwater cable.
Yeah.
That kind of, I saw that under the radar. There was some news about that, but that's actually very interesting to connect Israel to a much larger region.
Okay, so first of all, our slogan is to connect Israel, to connect the Israelis. Now, how we do that? We use the optic fibers, we use underwater cables to connect Israel from, actually there is a, we'll start with Google, there is a very interesting project that called Lou Raman, a cable that comes from India through Saudi Arabia, Djibouti, Jordan, Israel, through the whole ancient roads, the Perfume Road and the King Road, which mean the border with Egypt and the Arava.
These are like old trade routes.
Old trade routes, right. Yeah. And through the Mediterranean Sea, Sicily, and on and on, and Europe. And inside Israel, for the last 10 years, we actually, since, you know, for the last 12 years, since Netanyahu had a very famous speech in Kiryat Shemona about the Soviet tractor that moved very slow. And he talked about the internet, actually. And he said that in 2 months, we will have a high-speed internet. Nothing happened. Now, why? It's not, I don't think this is the right time to explain why for the last 12 years with Israel didn't do anything. But I can tell you that in the last 1 year, from 2%, we are now above 50% Israelis connected to high-speed internet. And we increasing the numbers day by day, and we hope that in the end of 2022 we'll have 70%. In my, I'm focusing specifically on the periphery. Why? Because when you can give a high-speed internet to someone that lives in the Golan Heights, in Metula, in the Negev, or in other places, and he can walk because optic fiber is 1 giga symmetric. When he can walk with the Silicon Valley or with Spain or with even Herzliya Pituach, and instead of taking his car and moving through the traffic, and he can actually develop everything. You can grow the economy, you can grow the labor circle in 3%, and you can just benefit from that. So mm-hmm. this is about money, and about conditions, and about encouraging people to move from Tel Aviv and from the centers to our borders, to the Galilee, to the Negev, instead of concentrating in the center. This is also about the 5G. The 5G is the future, or maybe the present. Our role is to make sure that there is an ecosystem that the companies will be able to earn from 5G. And when they are making money from 5G, we will be able to use this ability of IoT, Internet of Things, sensors that will connect your refrigerator to your iPhone and the car to the traffic light. And it's happening today. It's about agriculture, medical treatment, and on and on. And today, our main mission is to make sure that we have coverage all over Israel, that everyone will be able to connect through the mobile phone. They will have high-speed internet also in the mobile phone, and they will be able to use it for economic reasons, to develop, to have R&D in Israel, a very strong R&D in different companies, and on and on. In the upper level, there are those data centers that very important companies, big companies from all over the world.
Like Oracle set up here recently?
Oracle recently, and you have Google, and you have other companies that comes to Israel and build the data centers, which means that they believe in Israel. They believe that we are becoming the, as we said in the past, Taburo Shel Olam, the center of the world,
right,
as we had it in the past. And there are enough companies that will use those data centers in order to create this R&D inside Israel instead of moving to the Silicon Valley or the places in the world.
So the United States, the current administration and the previous administration were very worried about the security of our communications infrastructure. They didn't want China to be involved in building our 5G infrastructure. What are you doing, I guess, on that front to make sure that we're secure from possible data breaches, espionage, and other things, security concerns?
First of all, we have our own interest to make sure that we have in this field a kind of an iron dome. And this is an Israeli interest to make sure that no cyber attack will damage our ability to connect with each other or to keep information or to keep knowledge or data, whatever. Secondly, as you know, America, the United States, they are our best allies in the world. And we see eye by eye a different interest in those fields and in others. And we have a very strong discussions and connections. I actually visited Washington 2 months ago, and I had very good discussions with my colleagues in the White House and in the State Department and in other places, in the FCC. And we all understand that in order to make sure that the 5G will be a strong market and develop one, we need to invest a lot of effort, money, and ideas in creating a strong market with competition.
So in those talks with the Americans, these issues did come up? Yes. They expressed concern about this?
They expressed different concerns, and part of the discussions were regarding this 5G, if you want this Cold War above 5G.
And do you think that as a result of that, we'll see a cooperation between Israel and the United States more closer in terms of developing technology and in deploying that technology in different markets?
We decided on opening working groups together on developing different applications and R&D and to have outcomes that based on the 5G. Mm-hmm. 5G itself is not only a net that connect and can create calls between people. It's about transferring information and about actually have an high-speed internet based on sensors in one place, in concentrated place, and we use it for different causes. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the main concerns of different actors in the world, in the international community, but it's also an opportunity to have sensors on every tomato in one field can
improve your yield and what you
exactly,
can. Yeah,
to right. have sensors in a baseball stadium, you can actually control and to improve.
But you don't know how to play baseball, though, do you?
No. I know that there are a few Americans that know how to play baseball, so maybe we can help them to improve the market.
So on a different topic, you wanted to, you formed this committee to decide how to regulate social media, that Israel might end up being a sort of a world leader in considering social media companies to be publishers as opposed to just an open message board, and that they may be liable for their content. Opposition leader Netanyahu has now posted videos in English to tell the whole world that this is making Israel not a democracy anymore. Could you explain what your policy is?
By the way,
respond to Netanyahu if you have a response.
Let me just add that as a newspaper editor, in my view, they're definitely publishers. Because what do they do, Facebook in particular, is they take our content, not just the Jerusalem Post, every single publisher. They take our content and they monetize our content. And they make money off of our content because they make us pay them for us to get traffic
right.
through our content. So we have to hand it over to them. We have to pay them money. And they basically... they are totally a publisher, in my view, at least in that sense.
So I will tell you, first of all, I agree in part of the things that you said, but before that, I think it's quite shameful that Netanyahu published him a kind of a blame against Israel. I think he called Israel North Korea.
In English,
In English. I remember times that when Netanyahu and me, We criticize people from the extreme left, anarchists, that used different claims against Israel in English, Breaking the Silence and other organizations that belong to the BDS movement. Instead of dealing with problems and claims inside Israel and to do it in Hebrew, Netanyahu chose to publish it in English and to show the world what he thinks about Israel. And I must remind you that he was the prime minister half a year ago. So I thought that it was a shameful. After that, it's also fake news. It's not true. The bill that Netanyahu actually claimed in this short episode as an actor, this bill was something that Netanyahu, the Likud actually created 2 years ago. And the bills that allow police officers to have a search in a different criminal house, this is a tool that we need to use in order to fight and to cope with the violence in the Arabic population. And in general, I think that what Netanyahu tries to do is to say that if he is not the prime minister, there is no prime minister can sit in his holy place, in his holy chair. And if he is not the prime minister, and if he is not, if he has no coalition, so the state of Israel is
on the verge of extinction. Is under great threat.
Is not under great threat. If he is not the prime minister, no one can live in Israel peaceful.
Uh-huh.
This is not the state of Israel that we know. The Zionism dream not exists anymore, and he showed it when he actually forced his people, his Knesset members, to vote against a Zionistic bill that stopped the reunion of Palestinians from abroad. And he showed it while he forced his people to vote against other Zionistic bills. And he showed it when he actually encouraged his people, his Knesset members, to put a flag of North Korea. And I thought, when I saw it, I really thought that this is the one red line that he crossed, one step that he took too far.
But I have to ask you, we ran a poll this week together with Ma'ariv, of what would happen if the elections were called today and what would the parties get. Netanyahu was still getting, I think, 33 seats. Naftali Bennett, who's prime minister, is only getting 6 seats. Your party, New Hope, is not crossing the electoral threshold. So he might be crossing those lines, and I think you're right in that sense, but it's popular. People like it.
Yeah.
And to you, I would say, okay, that might be the right thing, right, in quotation marks, but that's not getting you votes from Israelis.
First of all, it's popular, and you cannot eliminate that. But at the same time, his popularity didn't give him the ministry, the prime minister office, because he has no 61 mandates. And this is the numbers that we saw in the last 4 circles of elections. Secondly, it's not about popularity. As you remember, I'm a historian. So I must use the Shabtai.
Like the Shabtai Tzvi.
The Shabtai
Tzvi.
Shabtai Tzvi example.
The false Messiah.
The false Messiah. That the majority of the Jewish people believe that he is the Messiah. And a lot of people, thousands of people actually moved after him when he became a Muslim. Because they believe that he is the Messiah. And if he says that you need to be a Muslim after a few years, you need to be a Muslim. And what I see today, it's a kind of Shabtai Tzvi. Whatever he says, it's good.
It's like a cult, what surrounds Netanyahu.
Sure. For sure, it's a kind of a cult. If he says that you need to vote against a Zionistic bill, you vote against it. If he says that this engagement in Gaza, in Gaza Strip, in Gush Katif, is the right thing to a right winger to do, they will tell you, yes, you need to evacuate Jewish villages. If he says that to release 1,000 terrorists in a deal, this is the good thing to do, they will tell you, yeah, this is what a right winger in Israel is doing. And they believe in everything that he says. So this is the main concern, because if he puts a flag of North Korea and he says to the world, this is North Korea, they believe that we live in North Korea. They believe that what Netanyahu says, it's true. And I think it's dangerous for Israel.
Right.
So I'm very happy that he doesn't have 61 mandates, but still the fact that there are so many people that support him, it's things that we need to change, and we'll change it by outcomes, by convincing people to prove that we are doing what we are doing, and we can fulfill our vision and mission.
So I think we're running out of time, but I do want to get back to that social media policy, because I do want to know what the policy is at this point.
All right. So my policy is, first of all, to make sure that we, dealing with transparency and responsibility. First of all, to make sure that Facebook and other companies, Meta, knows how to give the Israeli audience answers. If someone block you tomorrow morning, one of the Israeli companies, you will have an answer in 1 hour, 2 hours, with 24 hours. In Meta, in Facebook, they can block you tomorrow morning, or to block a Jerusalem Post, without any responsibility. They can just choose to do that, and you have nothing to do. And it's not working like that in the Israeli media, in the Israeli market. Secondly, about editing. If you have responsibility for what you are editing, and I can suit you for what we are doing, if you choose to publish some fake news or to lie about me or about other
libel, slander, any of those things. Right?
Exactly. Facebook and the other networks, they have no responsibility today. They can do whatever they want. They add posts. They can pick different words that they will raise or they will decrease, and they have no responsibility. So what we are doing actually is to, first of all, to try to understand how you regulate the sky. Why the sky? Because 200 years ago, people stood and thought that the sky are some dimensions that you cannot touch. And then came the airplanes. And then you had the commercial airplanes. And suddenly, today, it's quite obvious that we regulate the sky. So the internet, it's also some kind of dimensions that we didn't think that it's under our responsibility. But since all the media is moving to the internet, and instead of broadcasting through the satellites or through, broadcasting, you use optic fibers and you transfer information based on the internet. And since there is no, for my mother, there is no difference between SMS and WhatsApp. For her, it's the same thing. We need also to give some answers about regulation.
So it's not about telling Facebook what posts they're allowed to put up. It's just saying, if you're putting up a post, don't think that you will not be held accountable for what that post says.
Well, sure, I want responsibility. And if there are bots, robots in the Facebook or in other places, I want it to be clear. And to be that the public will know that this is a robot and not a real human being. And if they publish some, posts that call people not to vaccinate and risking lives, I want them to take responsibility that someone will be able to sue them, to tell them, look, you risk my life and my family life, and I believe this post. If they choose to raise this post, if it's just a post. So this is a kind of a discussion or debate about the platforms. If Facebook is only platforms, or only a platform, or it's something else.
It has the companies nervous, though, I think, right?
Yeah, in one way or another. But it's not only in Israel, I must tell you. There is a hearing in the States, in Washington, and you know it. And the European Union is dealing with that, and they are planning to deliver some bills in the beginning of 2022. And Israel also should be there, and to understand that we are in a different episode regarding the internet in general and those companies specifically.
Okay. Well, Minister of Communication Yoaz Hendel, it was great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Hope you enjoyed the interview with Israel's Minister of Communications, Yoaz Hendel, and thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Jerusalem Post podcast. Like always, we'll be back next week, and you can find us on all the different podcast platforms, Apple, Google, Spotify. Share it with all your friends, family, and anyone else you might know who might want to listen to Lahav and I talk the news, speak to interesting people. Have a great weekend.